So we're on March the 13th, 1922. Otherwise, I'll be shot. So the great good on hearing the truth. This is the beginning of something that will continue on into the higher volumes, and that is the Lord emphasising the importance of reading and studying the texts and telling us that no matter how much progress you think you have made, that it is very important to keep the study of the texts going. Okay? So Louisa said, I was in my usual state and I found myself in the midst of a flowery valley in which I found my late confessor who died at the 10th of the current month. Now, is there a note in your book to tell you who that is?
No.
It's Father Gennaro Di Gennaro, the confessor that she had for years and years in the early stages of the volumes. Okay? Father Gennaro, G-E-N-N-A-R-O, Di Gennaro, G-E-N-N-A-R-A-O. That's a bit like saying Joseph of Joseph.
Yeah, right.
It's very unusual. Father Gennaro, Di Gennaro. Okay. He was her confessor for many years. And he's going to tell her something that's actually terribly important. Now, he's now on the other side because he has died. Okay. So I found my late confessor. She's an out-of-the-body experience. According to his habit, when he lived down here, that is in this low place of the earth, he told me, tell me, what did Jesus say to you? Because apparently that's what he always said to her. What did Jesus say to you? And Louisa said, watch this now. This is very interesting. He spoke to me in my interior. He did not tell me anything with words. And you know that I don't take into account the things I get in my interior. That's absolutely incredible, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Now, but the thing is that concurs with the teaching of John of the Cross, not to pay attention to everything you get in your interior, because it's so hard to find out what's you, what's him, and what's a mixture of you, him, and anything else you've read or heard of or whatever. And she said, I don't take into account the things I heard in my interior. Now, and the priest said to her, I want to hear also what he told you in your interior, because he had given her the spiritual guidance for years and knew it was Jesus. Okay. So Louisa said, as though forced, in other words, the priest has asked it, that Jesus said, my daughter, I carry you in my arms, because she's in the divine will. Okay. My arms will serve you as a little boat to let you sail in the interminable sea of my will. Then as you do your acts in my will, you will form the sails, the mast, the anchor. Notice they're doing it together. Okay. Which will serve not only as an ornament to the little boat, but to make it move faster. The love I have for one who lives in my will is so great that I carry her in my arms without ever leaving her. Isn't that fantastic? And while he was saying this, I saw the arms of Jesus in the shape of a little boat. Now, that would be very interesting to see, wouldn't it? And myself in the middle of it. Okay. So Jesus is going to talk to her now about drops of light and understanding. On hearing this, the confessor told me, you must know, and he's teaching her from the other side, which is very, very interesting, that when Jesus speaks to you and manifests his truths to you, it's like rays of light that drop upon you. This is where you get the drops. Okay. Back then, that's when he was on the earth, when you manifested them to me, not having his virtue, that is power, you manifested them drop by drop. Because Louise is always saying how difficult she finds it to express it. And yet my soul remained all filled with these drops of light. Now, there's another way of talking about divine will, drops of light. I think it's absolutely magnificent because the divine will is light and we're only able to take it sip by sip. That light gave me, one, a greater spur. And two, it gave me more desire to hear the truths, to hear more truths. In order to be able to receive more light, because the truths being celestial fragrance and divine sensation, and this was just by hearing them. What must it have been for Louisa to receive it directly? What then will it be for those who practice them? Now, there's a huge difference between hearing and putting into practice. If you go to the letter of St. James, I think it's chapter 4, he says that there's no point in just hearing the word and not going away and putting it into practice, because there will be judgment for those who have heard and have done absolutely nothing about it. But St. James gives it to you in a very eloquent way. So it's in chapter 4, it's in most of the chapter 4, I think. So he said, what would it be like for those who actually practice them? This is why I desired so much to hear what Jesus told you, and I wanted to tell others. Now, look at that. Mm-hmm. Anyone who has genuinely got divine will wants to share it with others, because it's such an incredible treasure. You can't keep it to yourself. It was light and fragrance that I felt, and I wanted others to share them. Now notice, this is at the very beginning. We're only on volume 14 here. The priest is saying that he could actually tell others that if nothing else happened to you, you get this wonderful divine fragrance. Look at the way it can be introduced. This light, and there's enlightenment in it. So that's another way of approaching the thing. It's really interesting. If you knew the great good that my soul has received in hearing the truths which Jesus was saying to you. Normally in English we would finish that sentence, but in these writings the sentence is never finished. You know, it would be that you would do something about it or whatever. How it still drips with light and emanates celestial fragrance, which not only gives me refreshment but serves as light to me and to those who are near me. Where is the priest if he says to those who are near me? He's in purgatory, yeah. Okay, because Jesus says in these writings that 9 out of 10 people go to purgatory. That is the ones who are saved.
So he was in the divine will.
He was, yeah. Mm.
He's in purgatory.
Well, this is the early days. This is the early days. Louisa has only moved into divine will. Nobody else has.
Okay.
Yeah. And he's guiding her as a priest, not knowing where this thing is going. All he knows is that what Jesus is saying to her is having this effect on him. And this is before the kingdom of the divine will is established. Mm. We're only on volume 14 out of 36. Mm. Okay. So this is very early days. Well, I'll finish this and then say something that's actually quite important. But as you do your acts in the divine volition, I take special part in them. Now, notice the special part, because he had been her spiritual guide. Okay. Notice it's in the present tense where he is now. Because you know the acts affect everybody in heaven, in purgatory and on earth. Okay. Because I feel the seed of his most holy will, which you are sowing in me. Now, Louisa is not a bit shy talking to people in and out of the body experience. So she said, okay, show it to me. How do you drip with light? I want to see it. It's really funny. You couldn't say that to somebody on the earth, really, you know. Let me see your soul, she said. How does it drip with light? He opened himself at the side of where the heart is, and I saw his soul all dripping with light. Those drops were merging and separating, one flowing over the other. It was beautiful to look at. And he said, have you seen how beautiful it is to hear the truths? Those who do not hear them drip with such darkness as to strike terror. That's coming from the priest now. Okay. Now, the bit I want to sort of dialogue with you for a moment is to let you see that he had been a spiritual director to Louisa. And here he is now on the other side telling Louisa that he was growing and needing the teaching that she was giving to him. This is the way the Lord does things. He always works at both ends of the line. And if you look at the history of the church, we have quite a number of people like this. Catherine of Siena, Father Raymond of Capua. Now, he wasn't canonized, but he was made venerable or beatified. So while he was directing her, she sanctified him. Okay. You have Francis of Assisi and Claire of Assisi. You have Francis de Sales and Jane de Chantal. You have Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross. And there's lots more. But I want you to see that the Lord is working at both ends of the line. And when the Lord is making a saint and somebody is trying to guide that person is way beyond where the guide is. And so you're automatically pulled up the mountain. It's absolutely beautiful. The church has loads of testimony about that. There are others as well. There's St. Faustina's, at least one priest that guided her as well. There are others.
Mary and Claude.
Claude de la Colombière. Yeah. That's Margaret Mary Alacoque, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. It's just that when you start thinking about it, you realise... I hesitate to call them couples in case I'd be completely misunderstood, you know. But there are souls that are coupled together to take this journey. Now, sometimes the Lord does it differently. In times of crisis in the church, the Lord often brings forth saints as a bunch of grapes. In the early part of the 20th century, you have Padre Pio, Maria Valtorta and Luisa all living close to each other. And the three saints being brought up together and the Lord revealing himself to all of them from different angles, all at the same time. If you look at Saint Therese of Lisieux, she came out of a household of saints. They're all saints, even if they're not all canonized. And so in the situation that we have in the world today, the Lord is making the divine will family knit together to protect ourselves from the disaster of the darkness that's out there, so that we can actually go on in the journey of the divine will. You couldn't do it by yourself. You wouldn't be strong enough, you know. Some people are, but they're very unusual. Okay. So Martha 16, 19, 22, to live in the divine will has nothing great externally. Everything passes between the soul and God. And this is a very important message, that the mission of divine will is interior. So no big projects, no big hoo-ha. He's not going to let you work big miracles out there. And so you'll do what some of the evangelists do in America, run these mega churches and there's thousands and thousands and you're working miracles. That's not how divine will works. Divine will gives you such power to reach people internally that it would be a disaster if they knew you were doing it. Does that make sense? And so he leaves you looking perfectly ordinary, tuppence halfpenny on the outside. That is, if you are tuppence halfpenny like me. And the whole mystery is going on internally, which I absolutely love. And of course, that was the reality of his mother. During her lifetime. That's what he's going to tell you here. So Louisa says, continuing in my usual state, I was thinking to myself, I feel that I am, my book says, the most bad, which is wonderful English, that I'm the worst of all. Yet my sweet Jesus tells me that his designs upon me are great. So it seems a contradiction in terms. That the work which he is doing in me is so important that he doesn't want to entrust it even to the angels. But he himself wants to be the custodian, the actor and the spectator. Yet, what great things do I do? Nothing. My exterior life is so ordinary that I do nothing beneath others. Okay? I do things beneath others, which is very poor English. In other words,
less than.
Yeah. Because what she did was crochet. Do you know what I mean? She didn't make the dinner. She didn't clean the house. She didn't visit the neighbours. She didn't visit the old and the sick. She didn't do anything outside. So it seemed as if she was doing absolutely nothing. Yeah. So while I was thinking of this, my beloved Jesus, cutting off my thought, sometimes he did because he couldn't take any more of it, told me, my daughter, it shows how without your Jesus, you can think and say nothing but nonsense. Okay, I love it. That's John 15:5. Without me, you can do nothing. Good, understood. And Philippians 4:13. But with him, I can do everything. My dear mother, sorry, I don't do the mamma bit. It's far too Italian for me. My dear mother also did nothing extraordinary in her exterior life. Even more, apparently, she did less than others. And that's what Louise was trying to say up there. I appear to do less than others. She lowered herself to the most ordinary actions of life. She would spin, sew, sweep, light the fire, same as everybody else. Who would ever have thought that she was the mother of God? You can't say, God, in English. You can't say that, would be heresy. Because in English, that would presume other gods. But that's a transliteration of Italian, in which the A is required in the Italian, but not in English. Her external actions indicated nothing of this. And when she carried me in her womb, containing the eternal word within herself, every motion of hers, every human action won the adoration of the whole of creation. Okay, that's your Romans 8:19. That the whole of creation was waiting for this daughter of God to turn up. That would start the whole redemption, and therefore the kingdom of the divine will afterwards. From her came the life and the preservation of all creatures, animate and inanimate. The sun hung upon her, expecting the preservation of its light and heat. The earth, the development of the life of plants, everything hovered around her. Heaven and earth hung upon her every motion. Yet who saw anything? Nobody. All her greatness, power and sanctity and the immense seas of goodness which came out of her were all in her interior. Each one of her heartbeats, breaths, thoughts, words were an outpouring into her creator. They were continuous currents between God and her, which she would receive, give and receive. Nothing would come out which would not wound, that is, touch deeply her creator, and by which she would not be touched and deeply affected by him. These currents expanded her, raised her, and made her surpass everything. That's why in these writings, Louisa says, the height of the Blessed Mother. That means the summit of sanctity. Okay. But no one saw anything. I alone, her God and her Son, was aware of everything. Notice I alone, not Joseph. Joseph would have been aware of the fact that she was very holy and all the rest of it, but he wouldn't have been aware of the fullness of the grace that was in her. Such currents, you'd have to put S there, ran between my mother and I that her heartbeat would run within mine and mine within hers. So she lived from my eternal heartbeat and I from hers. He's talking about living at the divine will level. Therefore, our lives were blended together. And this was exactly what, in my eyes, distinguished her as my mother. External actions do not satisfy me, nor do they please me, if they do not start from the interior life that is formed by me. Now, so we're studying divine will, and he's saying, if the actions don't begin in the divine will, they're not divine actions, and therefore he's not interested. That's like somebody showing you a photograph of a 1,000 euro note, if there is such a thing. I don't know if there is or not. What's the use in looking at a photograph of it? If they gave you a real one, it would be different. And so he's not interested in things that don't come out of his divine will. Now, what is your wonder if your external life is completely ordinary because all the reality that's happening is interior? I am used to covering my greatest works with the most ordinary things. You have to look under a mountain to try and find diamonds. You won't find them anywhere else, because to produce the diamond, you need the weight of the mountain working on it. You have to go searching in the earth looking for gold. You've got to really go searching in the sea looking for pearls. Okay, he covers his great works. Always. And they're always hidden. Okay. So that no one may point to them and I may be free to operate. Now, he's talking about his great works in the spirit. if you take Bernadette of Lourdes, nobody would have given a second thought to this poor girl whose parents couldn't feed her. And from the time she could walk, was out in the fields minding sheep. Nobody would have known what was going on inside of her or what God had intended to do with her. If you take Thérèse of Lisieux as well, a sickly child who lost her mother at a very early age and didn't really get over it, who would ever have thought that she would become a doctor of the church at 24, do you know, that kind of thing. So he hides his works so that nobody will see them. Now, if everybody in your household knew exactly what the Lord was doing inside of you, they'd interfere, either to improve it or challenge it or whatever, because human beings actually interfere with whatever. So the Lord allows you to carry on a normal life with them, okay? And yet he's doing this stuff inside of you. Do you see what I'm saying? And the anonymity that he wants on the outside is the protection for the grace he's given you on the inside. And very often he lets you live with someone who wouldn't understand and would be actually frightened if you told them. And so it's actually very interesting. And that actually protects you from telling them. And whatever you tell, I don't know what you tell them to manage to get to a class, but whatever you tell them, it has got to be to protect the gift. Am I talking English to anybody? Yeah, it's actually terribly important. If my neighbours knew what was going on in this house, they would have interfered long since. Few of them tried, but I managed to put on my monster face. So the Lord likes to be free to work, and so he wants the privacy on the outside. Okay. So, and when I have completed everything, you see, he waits until nobody can interfere anymore, the job's done, and then he doesn't care whether you like it or whether you don't, it's done. Okay. I make surprises and I manifest them to everybody. That is when it's safe. So he's not going to manifest this until Louisa is long dead. Very few will know in her lifetime. Okay. And then causing all to remain astounded, all meaning from the Pope downwards, to remain absolutely astounded at the grace that was given to this woman. And it is certain that the work I am doing in you is great. Now, Louisa cannot grasp what he's saying to her. And the priest can't either. The priest knows that the Lord is saying wonderful things and he's getting wonderful grace. He can't see that a completely new era is being inaugurated. He can't see that at all. And if he could, he probably would have dropped out of the thing. Do you think it's a small thing? My text says trivial. Do you think it's a small thing that I make all your acts run in the current of the divine will? Nothing can be greater. And that the current of my will runs in your acts? After all, you're only a little thing. And that as these currents run, they form a single act, and with all the acts of creatures, making a divine volition flow over all of them. Now, this little bit about the divine acts is essential. It's foundational for teaching about divine will acts. So the divine volition flow over all of them, becoming the actor or the doer of each act and each one. I prefer the word doer. Actor can, because it's a translation of a word in Italian that makes sense. But in English, to me, an actor is someone who's pretending. Mm-hmm. It's the one who does it. So I call it the doer of the act, okay? Becoming the doer of each act, of each one, substituting for all with the divine act, a divine and eternal love, reparation and glory. Do you think that's small? It's unbelievable, isn't it? And that the current of a human will is in continuous relations with the divine will, and that they pour into one another. Now, those sentences are put together. They obviously make sense in Italian. As grammar, they make no sense. I'm just not going to change it into English for you. Is that all right? I hope they will get a decent translation. My daughter, what I recommend to you is that you be attentive and that you follow me. In other words, try not to work out what the jigsaw puzzle is going to look like in the end. Just go along with me and let the pattern develop, is what he's saying to her. Okay, so now you get a complete change in topic, because Louisa has the ability to receive something divine like this from the Lord and then turn around and tell him something trivial. So the next paragraph is about distractions. If you want to know the trivial from the divine, okay? So how to deal with distractions is the next paragraph. So Louisa said, "My love, in these days the circumstances have been such that I feel distracted." She doesn't ask him about all these divine will acts and how on earth they can run in the current of the divine will and how the divine will can be the doer of my acts. I would have thought she'd have 100 questions. No, she tells him she's all distracted. It's mind-boggling to me. In my book, you see, I've got headings. I need time to sort of say, my God, she never asked a question about that. And I would think the Lord would have been astounded as well. So she said, "I felt distracted." And he said, "Therefore be attentive." Now, what does attentive mean? That you recollect, that is, recollect your thoughts. Recollection is recollecting your thoughts. Or if we put it into modern language, try and take control of the thoughts that are in your mind. So be attentive, he says, because when all that you do does not flow in my will, the distractions won't flow in the divine will, you know. It happens as if the sun stopped its course. Now, why she never asked him to explain it is beyond me completely, completely. And he tells her something totally off the Richter scale like that, and she lets it go. And when you are distracted, you form clouds before the sun and you remain obscured. Therefore, when the distractions are involuntary, a strong and firm act of your will to run in my will is sufficient to place the sun in its course. In other words, take control. That's all. Take control. Say no to yourself. I'm not going down that route. Okay. So that's the strong and firm act of your will, which will act like a rapid breeze to dispel the clouds in order to make the sun of my will shine more beautifully. Okay? So the good instruction there about how to get control of your mind, but how she didn't ask him 100 questions, I just can't get it. Maybe like the rest of us, she doesn't hear it all. She's able to give it back in words, but that doesn't mean it has penetrated.
Yeah.
And so you'll find all of this stuff explained as you go along. He has to do it because she hasn't asked. You know, some of you will know that as a teacher, you can be quite frustrated that you've told the class something and not one person has a question, and then you realise they didn't hear it. They heard words, but they didn't actually hear what you were saying. Okay. So March the 18th, 1922, it's the devastation that sin works in our lives. Now, this is the exact opposite of what we've been talking about in the last one. Louisa said, "I was accompanying my sweet Jesus in the pains of his passion. And he, making himself seen, told me, 'My daughter, sin chains the soul and hampers her from doing good.'" Number one, her mind. You really need to watch this now. Her mind feels the chain of sin and is hindered from understanding. So the mind is blocked from understanding. Number two, her will feels the chain that wraps her and it feels numb. And instead of wanting good, it actually wants evil. And number three, her desires. Look at the three: her mind, her will, her desires. These are chained and feels its wings with which to fly to God being clipped. This is why you'll find some of the prayers of Louisa going into these areas, asking the Lord to free them when she's doing her reparations. Oh, how I feel compassion at the sight of man chained by his own sins. We'd say hanging by his own petard, wouldn't we? This is why the first pain I wanted to suffer in my passion was the chains. Now, one of the things I love in these writings is how Jesus explains that every single detail of the passion was reparation for some detail in us. Okay, so there's the chains. I wanted to be bound in order to release man from his own chains. Okay, chains for chains. I wanted to be bound, okay. Those chains which I suffered, as soon as they touched me, turned into chains of love. Anything that touches him turns into love because he is either divine love in heaven or incarnate love on the earth. Okay. So it turned into love. And in touching man, burnt up and snapped his chains that bound him with my loving chains. Isn't that lovely? So chains for chains. Isn't that awful? Okay. Thorns for thorns. And so the next long paragraph is the work of love, because that's everything that Jesus did was a work of love. And I want to give you a little heading for it. Love lives by giving, giving all. Love lives by giving, comma, giving all. Now, it's a famous statement, and I just can't remember who said it. I'm only quoting it. Please don't think it came out of me. Okay. He says, my love is operative. That means it's active. Use a word that we use. My love is active. In other words, it's not passive. I'm not just walking past you, wishing you well. It cannot be without operating. That means expressing itself in words, in works. Okay. It cannot be without expression in works. So his love is not theoretical and it's not passive. Therefore, I prepared for all and for each one that which is needed in order to rehabilitate them, heal them, and embellish them anew. Now notice the order. The human beings had to be rehabilitated into the kingdom of God first. Then they had to be healed. Now, if you watch the teaching of Jesus, particularly if you follow Maria Valtorta's works, that's exactly what he does. He teaches them and then he gradually rehabilitates them into the kingdom. Then he heals them and then embellishes them. He builds on what he has actually set up. I did everything so that if the soul makes up her mind, she may find everything ready and at her disposal. So, one, I keep chains ready to burn up hers. Now, to burn up her own is not English. We say hers. To burn up hers. Now, what would these chains be? Go to Matthew 11, 28 to 30. Take my yoke upon you, remember? And learn of me, for I am meek and humble of heart. Matthew 11, 28 to 30. And then you'll find rest for your souls. So, I keep chains ready to burn up hers. But if you go to the early volumes, I'm talking about volumes 1 to 4, you'll often, it's even higher than that, you'll often hear Louisa saying, he came and he tied me up in a rope, or he tied me up in these strings or whatever, you know, and she realises that she's being connected much more deeply to the divine will, you know. So it depends on where a person is at, whether you call them chains or ropes or threads of divine will, she calls them in the end. Okay. So that's to burn up our chains. The shreds of my flesh is number 2. That's from the scourging. To cover her wounds and adorn her with beauty. And number 3, my blood to give her life again. Notice everything is in threes. Because he keeps on saying that 3 is his divine signature. Okay. So I have everything ready. All we've got to do is tell the Lord we're a candidate and he works on it. I keep all that is needed in store for each one. Now, notice there's no specials in the kingdom of God. The redemption is for everyone if they want it, and the kingdom of the divine will is for everyone if they want it. But my love wants to give itself, because love lives by giving, giving all. It wants to work, wants to operate, okay? I feel a restlessness, an irresistible force that gives me no peace if I don't give, because love lives by giving. And you know what I do. When I see that no one takes, I concentrate my chains, the shreds of my flesh, my blood, in someone, we'd say someone, who wants them and who loves me. And I stud her with beauty, bejeweling her all over with the chains of my love. Now, in many places before volume 14, you've heard Louisa say that, that I was studded all over and all the rest of it. So notice he's saying here with his chains, with the shreds of his flesh and with his blood. Do you remember from the Hours of the Passion the meaning that Louisa gave to the shreds of the flesh, the shreds that fell, or that they were lost souls? So notice he's attaching them to anybody who loves them, because you have to get them back. You have to get them back for him. Okay, so he gives you these, because reparation and substitution are terribly important for us. You see, everything is given to her in very graphic language because she is an imaginative person, and you have to teach an imaginative person with pictures. But actually, giving pictures helps everybody to understand, you know. So it's just that you might have missed the shreds of the flesh as to what they actually meant. I increase 100-fold the life of grace for her. That's the person operating in the divine will. So that my love pours itself out and calms itself. It has somebody to pour itself out on. Mightn't be any harm to say to the Lord every now and then, here I am, pour it out on me. You mightn't want the consequences, but however. While he was saying this, I saw the chains, the shreds of his flesh, his blood running into me. And he pleased himself. We don't use the amused word. It's negative for us. He pleased himself in applying them to me and in bejeweling me all over, because she's the loving person who is willing to say, here I am, send me. How good is Jesus? We say how good Jesus is. May he always be blessed. Now, in the next little section that finishes this message, it's talking about resting in the Lord. Afterwards, he returned and he said, my daughter, I feel the need that the creature rest in me. Now, that's Psalm 61. Rest in God, my soul. My strength comes from him. It's said at least 3 or 4 times in Psalm 61. And Psalm 131, my soul is like a weaned child on its mother's lap. So Psalm 61 and Psalm 131. I feel the need that the creature rest in me and I in her. Now, the image I have in my head when I read that is the picture of a young daddy who has been asked to mind the baby while the mother gets the dinner. And the mother realizes that they're awful quiet. And she goes into the bedroom and the dad is asleep and the child is asleep on his breast. The two of them are resting in each other. I presume that's a normal picture for you. That's why I give it to you. And I give it to you because the Lord has told me to keep on giving messages from the family. Then you understand it. I rest in her and she rests in me. I love that picture. I think it's fantastic. And do you know when the creature rests in me and I in her? When her intelligence, number one, thinks of me. Remember intelligence? Okay. Memory. What's the other one?
Memory.
And will.
Memory.
The three. Okay. So when her intelligence thinks of me and understands me, she rests in the intelligence of her creator. Look at that. Now, resting in the intelligence, this is where I'm the one batting for people contemplating in the divine will, as distinct from continuously saying prayers. Because if you are to rest in the intelligence of your creator, that means no thoughts, no words, and no actions. You're actually resting. But what happens is that your intelligence is embellished by his, and your understanding is embellished from him. Wisdom grows in you. So don't make the mistake of continuously saying prayers. Maybe I'll be shot for saying that, but I'm the one fighting for contemplation in divine will. And that's this rest, because contemplation is resting in God. Okay. And letting God be God. I look at him and he looks at me. Now, you don't have to do all contemplation, but just make sure it's not all words. Okay. When her intelligence thinks of me and understands me, she rests in the intelligence of her creator. And that of the creator finds rest in the created mind. Look at that. That God finds a little place on earth where he can rest. Now, if God's intelligence rests in me, that's going to make a huge difference to me. Okay. Now, number two, when the human will, you were expecting that, weren't you? Unites with the divine will, the two wills embrace each other and rest together. Just make sure it's not all words. Okay. If human love rises above all created things and loves it's God only, what a beautiful rest God and the creature find reciprocally. Okay. So, intelligence, will, and love. Okay. Intelligence, will, and love. Three ways of speaking about the Trinity again. One who gives rest finds it. And I become her bed and keep her in the sweetest sleep. That's the sleep of contemplation. Clasped in my arms, and therefore come and rest in my bosom. Now, St. Thérèse of Lisieux would have said, yes, 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 that's the way to do it. Okay. So, March the 21st, 1922. This time we're talking about the Holy Spirit. Breathe on me, breath of God. And that's why in the Divine Will circles, that hymn has become one of our hymns. But many of the hymns that they sang in Charismatic Renewal are very suitable for Divine Will. And I think the Lord was preparing them to just take another leap. Okay. So Louisa said, continuing in my usual state, I was thinking again about the holy divine volition, and my adorable Jesus clasped me in his arms, and as he sighed intensely, I felt his breath, now the breath of God is the Holy Spirit, descend deep into my heart. Then he told me, daughter of my will, my omnipotent breath. Now the official words are Ruach Adonai, R-U-A-C-H, A-D-O-N-A-I, R-U-A-C-H, and A-D-O-N-A-I, Ruach Adonai, the breath of God. My omnipotent breath gives you the life of my will. Now, when you go to Genesis 2:7, you're told that when Ruach Adonai breathed into Adam, he became a living being. That means that he became alive spiritually. Okay, he was already alive physically. So my omnipotent breath gives you the life of my will. In fact, for one who does my will administers to her its breath as life. This is the Holy Spirit doing his part. And as it breathes upon her, it moves away from her all that does not belong to the Lord. And she breathes nothing but the air of my will, which will gradually be called balsamic air. Obviously, people in Italy knew about balsamic air. I don't know what it is. It is a continuous receiving of myself and giving herself to me at each breath. Now, I think the best thing I can do is get you to look at me for 1 second. That's God's name, breath of God. He's my breath. Yahweh. That was explained to me by the Jews. I said, where did you get the name? And they said, Yahweh. And they said, the old generation does, yeah. And the new generation says, whey. Isn't that fantastic? Mm. That's the breathing earth. Mm. Breathing out and breathing in. The breath of God keeps us alive and keeps life going on the planet. I had a wonderful experience at one stage in Durban in South Africa, where I was doing a parish mission there. And in the local hospital, at 11 o'clock in the morning, on floor 3, an old man died and his grandson was born on floor 1 at exactly the same time. And at the funeral, I did the breath of God for them, and we got the mother to bring her tiny baby. And we said, look, the breath was received by the next generation, and the breath was breathed back to God by the older generation. Everybody cried, not for sorrow, but for the mystery. And I said, just make sure you breathe the breath of God. Isn't it wonderful? That's just why I think it's better to illustrate it than to just explain it. Is that okay? And so the hymn, Breathe On Me, Breath of God, is terribly important for anyone in divine will. I love singing it. So that's the Holy Spirit breathing upon us. And if we have difficulty in anything with divine will, just say, breathe on me, breath of God. And then would you take a deep breath when you say it? So to make sure that you know you're actually doing it. Okay. So the next paragraph then is about the union of wills, the two wills coming together. My will hovers over the whole of creation. That is, nothing in which my will does not have its seal. Now, we dealt with the seal a couple of weeks ago, didn't we? You might have forgotten. But gradually, I'll show you the list of words that you need to pick up and study eventually, and seal is one of them. Okay. Now, this will of mine wants all things to be enclosed within itself in order to receive the return for its own noble and divine acts. It wants to see the air, the wind, the fragrance, the light of its volition hover over all human acts. Now, Louisa is being told, but she can't, she's not going to be able to hear this for some time, that what she's being taught is for all human beings to benefit. She does know, but it may not actually have hit her, you know, that it's affecting the whole human race. I want the divine acts to hover over all human acts in such a way that the divine acts hover together with those of the creatures, that they may fuse together and form one single thing. So there's your fusing. They fuse together, and the divine and the human act become one, divine and human. Okay. This alone was the purpose of creation. That the emanations, a terrible word, isn't it? The outpourings of the wills be continuous. So instead of emanations, you have outpourings, okay? I want it, I demand it, and I expect it. Now, that's the first time you actually read those words. I want it, I demand it, I expect it. Now, that's somebody who's acting like a king, okay? So this is why I am in such haste that my will and its value and its effects become known. And of course, it's only when he talks about them becoming known that Louisa has a problem, because she says, how can I tell anybody? I'm stuck in a bed and I can't leave it, you know. So that as the souls who live in my will do their acts, through their continuous outpourings in my will, they will diffuse them like air over everything, and their acts will multiply in all human acts, investing and covering everything as acts of my will. Isn't that a beautiful explanation there? Then will I obtain the purpose of creation. My will rest in them and will form the new generation, and all things will have the double seal of my will, the fiat of creation, and the echo of my fiat in creatures. That's absolutely beautiful. Very, very wonderfully put there. Okay. So, March the 24th. And here we talk about substitution, the acts in the divine will as substitution. Continuing in my usual state, my beloved Jesus, on coming, told me, my daughter, as the soul emits her acts, and that's much better than emanations, isn't it? As the soul emits her acts in my will, she multiplies my life, because each act is a divine life, isn't it? So, if she does 10 acts in my will, she multiplies me 10 times. If she does 20, 100, 1,000, and yet more, so many times am I multiplied. See, when we talked about acts years ago, introducing them, we wondered how many you had to do. Mm-hmm. And now we realise that they've got to be infinite, you know, because they've got to cover all human acts. It happens as in sacramental consecration. As many hosts as they place on the pattern, you'd have to add it for it to make sense. As many hosts as they place on the pattern. Do you see the words? Mm-hmm. So many times am I multiplied. The difference which exists is that in the sacramental consecration, I need the hosts in order to multiply myself, because that's the place where he lodges. I also need the priest who consecrates me. While in my will, in order to be multiplied, I need the acts of the creature in which my will consecrates me and encloses me more than in a living host. That's absolutely brilliant. So he's completely free of any external blocks. Okay? So more than in a living host, not a dead one. Like those hosts before the consecration. Why are the hosts before the consecration called dead? It's only bread. It's only bread. It's not a living thing. It's only after the consecration that a living presence is there. So I am multiplied at each one of her acts done in my will. Therefore, my love has its complete outpouring with the souls who do my will and live in my volition. These are the ones who always compensate, not only for the acts of the creatures owe me, but for my very sacramental life as well. So that's all that is left void in his experience. Okay. So how many times my sacramental life remains obstructed in the few hosts in which I am consecrated? This is very interesting, because there are few communicants. You have a whole ciborium full of hosts and it's left in the tabernacle. That's what he's saying. There aren't. He doesn't want to be hosts in a tabernacle. He wants people to receive him. It's us he's after. He doesn't want to sit in a box. Excuse me for saying it like that. Other times, there are no priests to consecrate me. I was in a parish in the Transvaal in northern South Africa, where one parish was the size of Ireland, and there was four Irish priests running it. They were run absolutely off their feet, and no matter what they did, they could not say Mass more than once a month in any area. Now, I don't mean a small area like Selbert, but I mean an area as big as Leinster. They might only manage to say Mass once a month. And even at that, they were going all the time. There's no let up, you know. So he's talking about in some places, there aren't enough priests to consecrate me. And not only is my sacramental life not multiplied as much as I would like, but it remains without existence. Okay, in other words, the consecration hasn't happened. How my love suffers, because love wants to give. Love lives by giving. I would like to multiply my life every day into as many hosts for as many existing people. That's 7 point something billion, okay? And give myself to them. And because here you're hearing that God loves us infinitely and we're blocking his love expressing itself. But I wait in vain. My will remains without effect. However, what I have decided will have its fulfillment. In other words, he has to work out a way to get round our blocks and to get round our deficiencies, okay? And he has found the brilliant way of us being living hosts, you see? So I take another way, and I multiply myself in every living act of the creature done in my will. So all the acts are automatically multiplied to infinity. To have them substitute for the multiplication of my sacramental lives. Ah, yes. Only the souls who live in my will substitute for all the communions that creatures do not do. It's good for us to actually remember it and say it as well, that I offer this in substitution. For all the consecrations that priests don't do, in them I will find everything, even the multiplication of my sacramental life. Okay. And it's important for us to also say to him, I receive you in your divine will on behalf of all those who can't receive you because either they're not baptized or they're in a foreign religion or they've given up faith or whatever. I receive you for them and I want you to reach out to them. So therefore, I repeat to you, your mission is great. I could not choose you for a higher, nobler, more sublime or divine mission. There's nothing that I will not centralize in you, even the multiplication of my own life. I will make new prodigies of grace never done before, like working out the divine hosts and everything. So I pray you to be attentive, remain recollected, okay? Be faithful to me. Let my will always have life in you, and I will find in you, in my own will, the work of creation fully completed with my full rights and everything I want. So he's able to achieve everything through the acts and the divine will. It's absolutely fantastic. But I think that these texts that we're reading tonight need to be taken in one sentence doses. While you might understand what's being said, it's actually difficult to take it in, you know, to get it to sink in. So I think it needs to be taken in small doses. So March the 28th, all that Jesus did on the earth is in continuous act. That means totally available now. And therefore, the response that we give is absolutely essential. Continuing in my usual state, I was fusing all of myself in the holy will of my beloved Jesus. And he told me, daughter of my will, if you knew the portents and the prodigies that occur when you fuse yourself in my will, you'd be stupefied. Our problem is we have words and we do the actions, but we haven't a clue, not a clue. We wouldn't be able to cope if we actually grasped the fullness of what we were doing. And so I always think it's a bit like you give food to a child and all they know is that they like it. They don't know what it's doing for them. Or you give them medicine and they don't know anything about medicine. All they know is that I don't feel as bad as I did before. Mm. And it's a bit like that, that we're not able to deal with it. Now, I think it's up in volume 25 or 6 where he says that the human mind cannot comprehend what he's actually saying. You have to trust him. Yeah. So, listen now, he said, all that I did, he's going to talk about redoing all our acts, okay? All that I did upon the earth is in continuous act. I like to call it continuous motion. Giving itself to man, surrounding him like a crown. My thoughts form a crown around the intelligence of man. My words, my works, my steps form a crown around the words, works and steps of man. When I say man, I mean the whole of humanity now. So that by braiding their things with mine, I may say to my celestial father that their works are like mine. Okay? Now, who takes this continuous attitude of mine? Who lets herself be braided by my works with which I crown the whole human family? Of course, it's one who lives in my will. As you were fusing your thoughts in my volition, my thoughts surrounded you like a crown. I think this is VIP. So my thoughts surrounded you like a crown, heard the echo of my thoughts in your mind, and identifying themselves with yours, they multiplied yours with mine and formed a double crown around the human intelligence. That's absolutely incredible. So the divine intelligence comes down and imbues itself into yours, and he manages through that to put a crown on all human intelligences. So there's an opportunity for people far from God to actually come back to him and remember him. And they're receiving this enormous grace. Isn't it just as well they don't know, and then they can't block it? Yeah. And so this is the Lord taking the wise course, you know. And my Father received not only from me, but also from you, divine glory on the part of all created intelligences. You probably know the prayer, Lord, I want to rise today in your divine will to cover all the intelligences of creatures so that all may rise. And you probably know it, do you? Therefore, I can offer you the submission and love and obedience of all created intelligences. So I say that soon, long before I wake up, because I wake up many times during the night. I prefer the divine acts during the night, you see. Just to make sure that all intelligences, while they're asleep, are covered, you know, so they can receive it better. So in doing this, all created intelligences are helped. The same with words and with all the rest. And he receives this divine glory not only from creatures, but from all other created things as well. Because all things were created to make continuous love run towards man. He continuously says that in these writings. Everything was made to send love in our direction. Okay. Coming from absolutely everything. And by justice should give homage and love to his creator for each created thing. Since everything was to send love to man, then man owes it to his creator to send love and homage back. Now, who compensates us for this? Who makes the fiat her own through which all things were made so as to diffuse homage, adoration, divine love for her creator over everything? It's one who lives in my will. She makes that omnipotent fiat her own almost at each one of her words. Look at that. The echo of the eternal fiat echoes within her divine fiat in which she lives, and it diffuses, it runs, it flies, impressing another fiat on each created thing and giving back to her creator the homage and love wanted by him. Nearly gets to be too much, doesn't it? I don't know about you, but I reach a point where it's saturation point, and you've got to go back and just take it at a different time, because this is very rich tonight, I think. Yeah. He said, this was what I did when I was on the earth. There was nothing for which I did not requite the Divine Father on the part of creatures. Now it is done, and I want it, I expect it. Oh, do you remember we've just had that? Uh-huh. And he expects it from one who lives in the divine will, because acts in the divine will can do it. If you could see how beautiful it is to see my glory, my love, my profound adoration united to yours in every flickering of the stars, in every drop of light of the sun. Oh, how it runs, it flies upon the wings of the wind, filling the whole of the atmosphere. It crosses the waters of the sea. It places itself in each plant, in each flower. It multiplies at each motion. It is a voice that echoes over everything and says, love, glory, adoration to my creator. Wow. Therefore, one who lives in my will is the echo of my voice, the repeater of my life, the perfect glory of my creation. How could I not love her? How could I not give to her all that I should give to all the other creatures put together, giving her primacy over everything? Isn't that amazing? My love would feel constrained if I didn't do that. Okay. So let's come to April the 1st, 1922. Louisa finds that the pain of privation that she suffers is like the pain of purgatory and may even surpass it. I'm going through most bitter days because of the privation of my sweet Jesus. And if he makes himself seen, it's like lightning that flashes by. What pain, what torment. My mind was darkened by the thought that my life, my all, would never come back again. That's the extraordinary thing about spiritual things. If we're going through a good space spiritually, we think it's going to last forever. And if we're going through a difficult space spiritually, we also think that's going to last forever. And when we're going through a very difficult time, we can't remember the good times. It's an extraordinary reality with regard to spirituality. Because spiritually, we're like very small children. Today's the only day that you have. You're created in the morning and you die in the evening. And so everything is in that one day. And the child doesn't go back remembering last week and all that kind of stuff. It just lives today. So Louisa is caught in this desperate pain that she hasn't got Jesus now. So she says, everything is over for me. What should I do to find him again? Now, just to remind ourselves that Louisa is living an absolutely abnormal life. She's not being nourished properly with food or with sleep. She's sitting in a bed. She should have osteoporosis. She should have muscle wastage. She should have bed sores. She should have all kinds of stuff. She should have an awful lot of internal complications. She has none of that. And that's by a miracle. But because her physical life is not being sustained on an earthly level, but only on a divine level, when the divine is removed, she actually is disintegrating. She's not actually exaggerating. Those saints who have lived only on the Eucharist have said the same thing, that if the Eucharist was denied them the following day, they would know they would die because they had nothing else. Okay, that the food was feeding them completely. So she, in the next paragraph, she describes a pain worse than purgatory. While I was thinking of this and other things, my beloved Jesus came and told me, poor daughter of mine, how much you suffer. Your painful state surpasses even the state of the purging souls. Now, if Jesus says it, he knows. In fact, if these are without me, it's because of sins with which they see themselves smeared and which prevent them from seeing me. And they themselves do not dare to come before me because before my infinite sanctity, there's not a tiny flaw that can stand before my presence. Now, at some point, would you take that line out of the book and put it on a clear page? And that's the answer to all of the people in this country who think that they can live hell on earth and still go to heaven. Is that okay? So, and right beside that, Hebrews 12:14, nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. So that's Hebrews 12:14. And then put Habakkuk, H-A-B-B, 1:13. Habakkuk 1:13 says, your eyes are too holy to look upon sin. Okay. And you can also put Revelation 21:27. Revelation 21:27 and Revelation 22:15. Now, in the two Revelation pieces, they're describing the New Jerusalem. And at the very end of the description of the New Jerusalem, you're told that anything unholy or unworthy is outside. Outside, you have to leave the dogs and the fornicators and the this and that and the other. And you're told it twice. Now, the strange thing is that Revelation 22:15 is about a couple of verses from the end of the Bible. It's one of the last things stated in the Bible that something unholy and unworthy of God will not and can not enter the presence of God. But the saints have described that supposing, I think C.S. Lewis tried to do this in that book, The Great Divorce, which I thoroughly enjoyed when I read it first, that a soul trying to enter the presence of God, if God allows it, that soul feels so uncomfortable with everybody they meet, they've nothing to say, they've nothing to share. Everybody else is operating at a much higher level. They feel there's nobody here at my level. And then they begin to realise after a while that everybody's looking at them. And that soul would actually have to send themselves to purgatory, realising, I cannot come back here unless I'm like them. I may be describing it awkwardly, but they were literally trying to describe a soul, how they would react in the presence of all love, all mercy, all forgiveness, all kindness, when they had blotches of the opposite on them, you know, really showing them. I don't know if you've ever met, if you've been in the presence of somebody really, really, really holy, it's very uncomfortable because it shows you up instantly. If you see somebody who is extraordinarily generous, it shows you up. Extraordinarily forgiving, it shows you up. It shows you up if you're the opposite. Just like if you're in the presence of somebody who is very wise and very knowledgeable, you'd shut up, you wouldn't open your mouth because you'd realise that every time you opened your mouth, you'd show your lack of it. Do you know what I mean? It's the same kind of feeling, you know. It's like I wouldn't go on a tennis court with some of these famous guys. You know what I mean? I couldn't even push the ball, let alone catch it. So you wouldn't go into that. You'd acknowledge I don't fit. I might be able to throw a ball, but I mean, it's not the same world as Wimbledon. That's a different world altogether, you know. And only certain people can go there, even among the tennis world. Only certain people can go there. It's the same with heaven. And so when you hear at funerals that the person is in heaven just because they died, it's total heresy. It's really sad. That's why I can't stand funerals, because there's so many lies told, you know. I had a friend who went to her mother-in-law's funeral, and the mother-in-law had been impossible to live with, you see. And at the eulogy, the mother-in-law was blown up to be, you know, saint, whoever it was. And her son was with her, and the son was about 15 years of age. And not realising what he was doing, at a moment of quiet between one eulogy and the next, he said to her out loud so that the entire congregation heard, "Mum, when it comes to your turn, can we tell the truth?" I think that was the most marvellous thing anybody at that funeral heard. Everybody laughed because they knew that what was coming from the altar was total lies. Because they all found the woman impossible to live with. And the young lad said it, not realising everybody would hear, which I thought was brilliant, you know. But anyway, we have to somehow gently say to people that only love gets into heaven. But not sick love. Only healthy love gets into heaven. Not aberrant love. Because nowadays they call the most extraordinary things love, don't they? Mm-hmm. Lust is called love. Mm-hmm. Okay. So only love gets into heaven. Because God is love. So then Jesus says, "But between me and the little daughter of my will, it's not sins that prevent me from making myself seen. It's my justice." Now, he's been telling her this for 14 volumes, but, I mean, some things we can't hear. "It's my justice that places itself between me and her. Therefore, your pain in not seeing me surpasses any other pain, because it's coming from God. And it's coming as part of your reparation. Poor daughter, courage. You have the same lot as me." Now, my book says "my same lot." Of course, that's not English. You've got the same lot as me. "How terrible are the pains of justice." Now, St. Therese offered herself as a victim to mercy, not justice. Louisa was asked to offer herself to justice. That's the worst of all. "And I can share them with one who lives in my will, because it takes a divine strength to bear them." At the pains of justice, he says, takes a divine strength. Now, in the higher volumes, Louisa herself will be able to say, what I am experiencing is a divine pain, which is incredible. But do not fear, I will return soon. So he's tried to tell her, and he has said it over and over again, that when he is not showing himself to her, he's doing chastisements outside. Okay. It's 1922. There's a lot going on in the world. I will return soon in the usual way. Let the rays of justice touch the creatures. My justice, too, must have its course. Nor will you be able to sustain it all. And then I'll be with you as before. But in spite of this, I am not leaving you. Joshua 1:5. I'm not leaving you. I too know that you cannot be without me. That's because of the great love between them. And therefore I will remain in the depths of your heart. Now that's the bit she doesn't really want. She wants it the other way. And we will plead together. Okay. So Louisa said, afterwards I followed the hours of the Passion, and I followed my sweet Jesus in the act in which he was clothed and treated like a madman. This is very interesting if you haven't read it before. My mind was wandering in the mystery, and Jesus told me, my daughter, the most humiliating step of my passion was precisely this, being clothed and treated as a madman. Why? Because he's God and because he's divine wisdom. And of course, the person who called him a madman was a great sinner and a killer, as you know, who was Herod. I became the amusement of the Jews, their rag, and Louisa describes that graphically to the point where it's hard to read. Great humiliation, my infinite wisdom, a greater humiliation my infinite wisdom could not bear. I think that needs to be coloured. This is divine wisdom humiliated into the dirt. That's terribly, terribly important. And because we don't know what divine wisdom is, we don't know the measure of the humiliation. Okay. Yet it was necessary that I, the Son of God, and of course the divine word incarnate, suffer this pain. By sinning, man becomes mad. Sin is madness. We all know that, don't we? We even say it, don't we? Greater madness there cannot be. And from the King that he is, you need to put the word that, or it doesn't make sense. From the King that he is, he, that's the human race, becomes the slave. Now, that's John 8:44. Anyone who sins is a slave, okay? He becomes the slave and the amusement of the most vile passions which tyrannize him, and more than a madman, chain him as they please, casting him into the mud and covering him with the most filthy things. Oh, what great madness sin is. In this state, man could never be admitted to the supreme majesty. There you have it again. Very clear language. Therefore, I myself wanted to bear this pain so humiliating, Isaiah 53, in order to plead for man that he might leave the state of madness, offering myself to the Eternal Father to bear the pains which the madness deserved. I've just remembered, it's also Psalm 22, and it's the last verse of Psalm 22. Pleading for everybody. He died pleading for sinners. So each pain I suffered in my passion was nothing other than the echo of the pains which the creatures deserved. Okay. That echo boomed over me. Look at the language. And subjected me to pains, scorns and derisions and mockeries and all torments. And the word is H-E-L-L. Jesus was actually given the hell that the wicked deserved. Isn't that extraordinary? So I'm going to leave it there for tonight.